Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Yes, hello and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's four proms in this 2012 season. They've arrived to perform music that's always been close to BBC SSO's chief conductor, Ronald Runnicle's heart.
I think it was very much to do with growing up where I did in Edinburgh, which was up in the Pentland Hills. And at this time in my life, I'm talking about when I was 15, when I was 16, the world of Richard Wagner was introduced to me through school and through a visit to Scottish Opera, and the music filled my head all the time. It was this love affair, like falling in love with the first time. You just cannot get it out of your head. And I have to say that I embarked with that on a journey which I continue now.
Well, later he'll be tackling the vast canvas of Bruckner's last completed symphony, his eighth, into which Viennese critics of the day complained he'd imported his hero Wagner's dramatic style. True or not, the eighth is still a magnificent achievement, and if it's Bruckner's largest scale work, then Wagner's Siegfried Idyll has to be his smallest. It began life at Christmas 1870 on the resonance staircase of his villa by the shores of Lake Lucerne. That was when Cosima Wagner, newly married to Richard, received a pretty special 33rd birthday present, the first performance by 13 musicians of her husband Siegfried Idyll. Not only was that the name of their young son, but Wagner was working on Act 3 of his music drama Siegfried at the time, and much of the material he uses in the Idyll appears in that act, particularly themes through which the hero, Siegfried, is glorified, and he and Brunhilde exchange expressions of undying love. In the opera, these are heroic, full-blown moments, but in the Idyll, Wagner toned everything down for this musical love letter to the woman who transformed his life and brought him a measure of stability and peace. The size of the original band was dictated primarily by the staircase of the Wagner home. Wagner later used more strings, as we'll hear tonight, though the beginning of the performance has solo players, as originally by the shores of Lake Lucerne. That applause for the guest leader of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, David Adams. And he's followed onto the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall by Donald Runnicle to conduct Wagner's Siegfried Idyll. Wonderful the way the Albert Hall manages to shrink to accommodate such chamber music playing. Just the small horseshoe of players and Long Radicals bringing the wind soloists to their feet. Particular mention, I think, of David Flack. Principal Horn is now on his feet, and Stella McCracken, the oboist. Wagner Siegfried Idyll, once described as a series of domestic confidences. Rather prosaic description of a wonderful birthday present for his wife, Cosima. Performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to open their first BBC Prom of 2012, live here on Radio 3. Home of the Proms by members of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Donald Runicles. The Idyll originally had another title, Triebschen Idyll, Triebschen being the name of their house on the shores of the lake, with Fidi, the nickname for their son Siegfried, then just 18 months old, Birdsong and Orange Sunrise. The Orange Sunrise referring to the colour of the wallpaper in Cosima's bedroom. Back comes Donald Runicles. And of course, if you'd like to keep up to date with what people are thinking about the Proms on Twitter, well, at BBC Proms is the place to go. And if you want to keep up to date with tonight's orchestra, at BBC SSO. Principal string players brought to their feet. Works really well, I think, going from the single strings of that original Triebschen performance to a rather larger group. Well, it's an early interval tonight in the Albert Hall, and that's because after it, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and Donald Runicles tackle a work that even for Bruckner is on a vast scale. His last completed symphony, The Magnificent Eighth. But for the next 20 minutes, from Scottish music-making to Scottish literature, as we join Rana Mitter for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just down the steps from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Just a few years ago, the Scottish public was asked to vote for the best Scottish book of all time, and their choice was a novel, Sunset Song by Lewis Grassic Gibbon. First published in 1932, the book tells the story of a Scottish farming community which is shaken to the core by social change and the devastation of the First World War. The book has influenced generations of Scots, including my two guests today, distinguished novelists themselves, Ali Smith and Jackie Kay. Would you please welcome them both here today? Ali, let me start with you. When did you first read Sunset Song, and what did it do to you?
Oh, okay. I was 16, and it was a set text at school. Now, and I had seen the girls and the boys, actually, in the year ahead of me, reading this book, you know, on school trips, on the buses, and inevitably they would be crying. You know, they'd be holding this book, and had a kind of windswept girl on the cover, and they would be holding this book, and, you know, whether they were male or female, they would be in the back of the bus going, oh, oh, and kind of holding the book like they couldn't put it down. And I was like, oh, I don't think I'm going to like that book. It looks like it's awfully hard going. You know, it's a bit sentimental. And we got to the year when we were going to read it, and I read it at 16. And I think, I literally think it blew me away. It was, I grew up in Inverness, and it's a northeast book. And we had read books from all over the world before that, Cry the Beloved Country, and we'd read, you know, lots of To Kill a Mockingbird, and then Sunset Song. And Sunset Song is written in a voice that was so close to me that I couldn't believe it, about a girl who was the same age as we were. And this was, it was like a whole door opened into what was possible with books for me.
Not everyone reacts that way, I have to say, to set texts at school, so it's delightful to hear they can have that effect. I mean, Jackie, your reaction to the book, and perhaps you can give us a bit of a flavour of the scene, setting the scene of the book for us.
Well, I didn't get the book at school. We did Cider with Rosie instead.
Oh,
for me.
Also a fine novel.
Good. Also a wonderful novel, but it was, we didn't get it at school. But I remember reading it around the same age as Ali at 16, and it really making a huge impact on me because of the heroine, Chris Guthrie, who is one of the most spirited women ever to appear in Scottish fiction, I think, anywhere, or in any fiction anywhere, not just Scottish fiction. It's really unusual to find a young woman heroine who's clever, who splits into several multiple selves, who kind of refers to herself sometimes as the English Chris and sometimes as the other Chris, and who is a hard worker, who loves the land, and who has a great feeling for the land, and but a great feeling for books and intellect too. So she completely stole my heart, this character in herself, Chris. And I also had the kind of the pleasure of watching Sunset Song when it was on television in 1971 when I was 10. And I just loved the televised version as well. I mean, I kind of completely fell in love with Chris, the character who we're lucky to have here. And I just found the whole book stunning, staggering.
Well, it's funny you should say, actually, there's a connection here because we actually have a special guest in the audience, the actor Vivian Heilbron, who actually played Chris Guthrie, the lead character of the novel, in a BBC television adaptation in 1971. I mean, Vivian, you play this very feisty, very lively character. What were your feelings about Chris?
I just loved her. Like, I think everybody who reads the book falls in love with that extraordinary, complicated, and not always absolutely likable character. There's the steel in Chris, as well as and a kind of way that she can stand back in a very objective way, which can be quite alarming in a person.
Well, Ali, it strikes me that in some ways that spikiness that Vivian's talking about is also part of that landscape that you've related the book to. And I wonder, could you just tell us, it related to the part of Scotland that you grew up in. Could you just set that scene a bit more for us? Tell us about the connection between, the land and the woman.
But first of all, I have to say, it's a bit like having Chris Guthrie actually in the room with us, having Vivian Heilbron here, because it really is extraordinarily exciting. For us, it's actually like having the character here. The spikiness of the North, there's a thing that happens in Gibbon's language which is really, really, really extraordinary, like no other writer that I can think of. The number of things he can do in the layering that he uses with his language. Much of it's written in the second person, and the you in this book is a really complex figure, set of characters, set of voices. So that the youth,
and these voices are a farming community at the beginning of the 20th century.
There's a young girl, she's growing up in a farming community, and the voice slips between the individual and the communal, the individual, and it slips within the turn of a single sentence. So you don't quite know where you are with the person, and every time you think you're fixed, it's shifted. And every time you think you understand something, it gives you the underside. And every time you think you're on the underside, suddenly it's boulevarded you again. And there's something very, skillful about the way that Gibbon manages to talk about both detachment and involvement in this, which is why we fall in love with Chris. Because she makes us love her, and at the same time, we can be outside there too. So, we're in both situations with her all the time.
Well, I really think we have to hear a bit more from the character of Chris, and who better than Vivian Heilbron, who's played her in such a distinguished way, to give us a quick reading. Vivian, I wonder if you might give us an extract from Sunset Song.
Of course. So that was Chris, and her reading and schooling. Two Chrises there were that fought for her heart and tormented her. You hated the land and the coarse speak of the folk, and learning was brave and fine one day, and the next you'd waken with the peewits crying across the hills, deep and deep, crying in the heart of you and the smell of the earth in your face. Almost you'd cry for that, the beauty of it, and the sweetness of the Scottish land and skies. You saw their faces in firelight, fathers and mothers and the neighbours, before the lamps lit up, tired and kind. Faces dear and close to you, you wanted the words they'd known and used, forgotten in the far-off youngness of their lives. Scots words to tell to your heart, how they wrung it and held it, the toil of their days and unending their fight. And the next minute, that passed from you. You were English, back in the English word, so sharp and clean and true. For a while, till they slid so smooth from your throat, you knew they would never say anything that was worth the saying at all.
A wonderful extract there. And Jackie, it reminds us that the novel is about many things. It's about the landscape, it's about the characters, but it's also about identity, and it's about what being Scottish is and what it isn't. Do you think that the novel actually, in a sense, defines itself against a variety of things, against the English, against the church, who also turn up in a not necessarily very friendly way in the book?
Well, I don't think of the novel as setting itself necessarily against the English. I think of it as setting its own terms, and I think that passage is a great illustration of that. The language itself, the language that the whole book is written in is a character, and you become immersed in the language, but you also become immersed in the landscape, and the landscape and the language are a song. They are the sunset song, and they're together, and it becomes its own self, and there are lots of characters. There's lots of things that the book examines and has a good laugh at: the kirk and hypocrisy of ministers, violence of men, the coming of machines, the changing of the times. It's a kind of a wry commentary on the time this is dealing with, but it also makes you laugh a lot. It makes you laugh out loud in several places, and it makes you frightened for the character. And the whole book's structured really like a great piece of music, which is why it's kind of fitting that we should be talking about it right in the middle of this prom, because it's a celebration of children and birth and land. Don't you think, Ali?
Yeah, I do. I also think it's a book that's absolutely about musical modulation in voice and tone and register, so that when Chris says that thing about he loved the Scottish words and how could the English words be any good, and then she thinks, no, the clarity of the English words, she's drawn to the clarity. The thing about Gibbon is he loves both. He loves the Scots sense of things, he loves the English sense of things, and there's a point at which he makes a marriage between them in this book that I don't think any other writer's ever done. He finds a lyrical force, which is at the same time the opposite of lyrical. You know, at the same time goes absolutely to the real. And he makes a hybrid language from Scots and English in a way that isn't the same as Braid Scots, you know, but is absolutely literary conscious. It comes from the same project that McDermott and Edwin Muir and Neil Gannon, the writers at the beginning of the century, were engaged in, which was...
And this is the Scottish Renaissance.
We now call it the Scottish Literary Renaissance. It's not the only one. There's been that last century, there was a few Scottish Literary Renaissance last century, but this one Gibbon is at the centre of, and he finds a force, a form, which is a force in itself.
But Ali, does that mean that there's a sense of artificiality about the language? I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, but I'm thinking of novels like, I don't know, The Great Gatsby might be an example of something where you're very conscious of the style. I mean, as a Scots reader, do you find that?
No, that's the thing that Gibbon does, because he's, at all points, this is a high literary style. Lyrical so that you can hardly bear it. You read Gibbon and you almost can't bear it. It's almost too much. And at the same time, because he keeps everything so close to the earth, so close to the land, so close to the way that people really speak, so close to the way that people think, and to the way that your heart beats. There's something about language in here which is about breathing. And so the sentences are so long and so kind of allow themselves to go beyond your normal breath that actually it makes your heart feel differently. So he goes direct to the source of your heart, and at the same time, he's doing this highly thing.
And there's something else that he's doing as well, Jackie, which almost goes without saying, but we have to say it. He is a man writing a woman's experience. And he's written actually very effectively about childbirth in the novel. Perhaps listeners will be relieved that we're not going to read that part right now. But there is another reading I wonder if you'd give us that expresses perhaps in a more quiet way how he manages to capture a particular type of woman's emotional experience.
Yeah, sure, and I particularly love this one. As Vivian was saying, she is a really interesting heroine, Chris Guthrie, because she's so complex. She's likable sometimes and not so likable other times, and she coolly looks at herself. And this scene, I think, is one of the most unusual scenes to come across in a novel written by a man for its time. It truly is quite extraordinary. But it was only for a second she thought of that daftly, then laughed at herself, cool and trim and trig, and closed the window, shutting out the smells of the night, and slowly took off her clothes, looking at herself in the long glass that had once stood in Mother's room. She was growing up limber and sweet, not bonny, perhaps. Her cheekbones were over high and her nose over short for that, but her eyes clear and deep and brown, brown, deep and clear as a Denburn flow, and her hair was red and brown by turns, spun fine as a spider's web, wild, wonderful hair. So she saw herself and gave her teeth, and her teeth clean cut and even, a white gleam in that grave brown stillness of face John Guthrie's blood had bequeathed to her. And below face and neck, now her clothes were off, was a glimmer of shoulders and breast, and there her skin was like satin. It tickled her, touching herself. Below the tilt of her left breast was a dimple. She saw it and bent to look at it, and the moonlight ran down her back. So queer the moonlight, she felt the running of that beam along her back. And she straightened as the moonlight grew and looked at the rest of herself and thought herself sweet and cool and fit for that lover who would someday come and kiss her and hold her so.
Jackie, something that I find almost impossible to believe when you read such a beautifully composed passage as that is that he wrote the entire novel in 6 weeks.
I know, it just seems absolutely incredible, kind of amazing, because he managed, it's such an achievement, this novel, in so many ways.
But what does that mean to you? I mean, you're a novelist yourself, you know, you're not just a reader, you're a writer. I mean, what does that achievement make you feel?
Envy. Pure and simple. I'm hoping to do it myself in a couple of weeks' time. No, I mean, it just seems an incredible achievement, because he writes about work in a way that's interesting, and in a way that we don't really get now in contemporary novels, this examination of the fields and the work and this hard, hard, back-breaking work, and yet this love of the land that's so close to you at times, it feels part of your own flesh, and then this very feisty, independent, knowledgeable, scholarly heroine, and then the war coming, and then the Kirk and the hypocrisy of the Kirk. So he manages to take the whole community in and sweep us up in this voice, and every so often it feels like a dance step, doesn't it? The way that it moves forward and kind of escapes melodrama by moving back and telling you about something that's happened after it's happened.
It's the first book in a trilogy, the Scots Quair, A Scots Quair it's called, and it's a trilogy which starts with this almost unbearable, adolescent, burgeoning, nostalgic, elegiac, and deeply spiky beginning, and then goes on and hardens and hardens and hardens through into the 30s. And he wrote the whole Quair in 2.5 years or something, given he was 30 years old, roughly, when he wrote this book.
And then died tragically young, of course.
And died very young, and he's written 17 books. I mean, it's as if he was an energy force, and then he just, you know, he really just... performed and then went, you know. But people thought at the first that this Lewis Cressy Gibbon might actually be a woman. There was a question about whether or not a woman had written this book and how a man could have possibly written this book. But that's what this book's about. At every point when you think something's fixed, to use one of his words, upjumbles you. It outcome, you know. He says at some point, you think you understand that, you know, you'll give a label to something, and then as soon as you look again, that label's changed, and the person has undone the package you've put them in, and, you know, the possibilities have changed because every time humans outdo category, and that's really, I think, what this book's about.
One of the other things that the book does is to move us from the particularities of one farm, one couple, a small community, to actually world-shattering events, because in the last third of the book, the Great War, the First World War, bursts in, and it does that to devastating effect. Is that something that would have had particular resonance with the generation that was reading it first?
Oh, are you kidding? Absolutely. This is 1932. The force of this book, but not just the force of the presence of the war in it, but the force of the presence in a lyrical form, and in a form which is both lyrical and poisoned, so that when you look at it's not quite the end of the book because there's a little epilogue at the end, but at the very end of Chris's part, the real Chris part of the story, as one of the characters comes back from the dead, as it were, there's this moment where something utterly romantic is held at the same time, as something utterly barbaric and ruined and bloody and bloodied. And how Gibbon holds both these things is how this book has force. He holds the lyrical and the real in the one hand and makes a kind of force of these two things. And after the war, what were you going to do? All the feelings you had and also the realities of it. That's what this book's about.
I mean, Jackie, there's also, it seems to me, a sense of disillusionment, simply because in the 1930s, when the book's published, Scotland, like the rest of Britain, of course, was going through the Great Depression. There's a feeling of a generation that had been betrayed. And one can in some ways read that back into the moral ambiguity at the end of the book. I mean, without wanting to give away too much of the plot, various of the characters do things, whether it's related to domestic violence, frankly, or behaviour in war, that make them quite ambiguous characters.
Yeah, so I think that's the other thing that I think is wonderful about Sunset Song, because he's not looking at people in a kind of one-dimensional way. Everybody in the book is complex. The interesting thing is land is changing all the time, progress is coming, the machines are changing, and therefore the characters are changing all the time in the same kind of pace.
And Ali, even the landscape in the book seems to reflect that feeling of an end of an era, a watershed, you know, an elegiac feeling. There's particularly one scene where trees are described on the estate in a, you know, really very, very impressive and moving way. And I wonder if you might read that for us.
Che went round all Kinraddy on his leave that time and found changes enough to open his eyes. Maybe he was fell wearied with the front folk, thought there was nothing on there but their pleatering and fighting. And the first change he saw the first morning did Che, lying down in his bed for the pleasure of it and Kirsty at the making of his breakfast. And Che sat up in his bed to reach for his pipe when he looked from the window and he gave a great roar and he louped from his bed in his sark so that Kirsty came running and crying, "What is't? Is't a wound?" But she found Che standing by the window then, cursing himself black in the face he was, and he asked, "How long had this been going on?" So Mistress Strachan looked out the way he looked, and she saw it was only the long bit wood that ran by the Peasy's Knap that vexed him. It was nearly down the whole stretch of it now. It made a guy difference to the lookout, faith, but fine for Kinraddy the woodmen had been. They'd lodged at the Knap and paid high for their board. But Che cried out, "To hell with their board, the bastards, they're ruining my land, do you hear?" And he pulled on his trousers and boots and would have fair run over the park and been at them, but Kirsty caught at his sark and held him back and cried, "Have you fair gone mad with the killing of Germans?" And he asked her, hadn't she got eyes in her head, the fool, not telling him before that the wood was cut? It would lay the whole Knap open to the northeast now and was fair the end of a living here.
Ali, it's a mark of a great novel, and this is clearly a great novel, that it is not confined within national boundaries. At the same time, we are living at the moment through a period when Scotland is looking at its own identity, and that's as true in culture as it is in everything else. Yeah. What do you think the continuing significance of Sunset Song is for Scotland today?
Scotland today and Sunset Song and Grassit Gibbon, it's all very... it's very close to what Grassit Gibbon was where he was politically when he was writing this book. There was a great weight on him to be a Scottish nationalist. There was a great weight on him to be a diffusionist. There was a great weight on this book to be a Marxist text. There was a great weight on Chris to be the land. There's a great weight on Chris to be Scotland herself. The book trails symbolisms after it like a lot of tin cans. Actually, this book outdoes all the trailing and all the symbolisms and all the isms, every ism there is. At every point, Gibbon dodges the ism, because when it comes down to it, he wants us to be human. Not even humanist, but human. And at every point when you come up against something where you think that there's a belief being forced at you or there's politics that, you know, that you're supposed to be listening to with an agenda, Gibbon outdoes it, makes it human, reminds you that there's a heartbeat in here.
And I think that the sun is going to have to set on our particular song at that moment. Oh. We've had a wonderful journey, so please do thank my guests today, Ali Smith and Jackie Kay.
Rana Mitter presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Laura Thomas. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, for the second part of tonight's BBC Prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the Proms. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra is making its first visit of the 2012 season with its chief conductor, Donald Runnicles, performing works which, for him, are very much at the heart of his musical world. In the first half, it was Wagner. Now we hear from his disciple, Bruckner. He was 63 when he completed his 8th symphony and sent it to his supporter, the conductor, Hermann Levy. He, though, just couldn't grasp the symphony's scale, and he said it was unperformable. That devastated the always totally insecure composer, who spent the next 3 years revising it, changing the orchestration and rewriting the music from small details to whole sections. The whole piece is made up of what you might call symphonic waves, the accumulation of increasingly powerful climaxes, the very opening which starts hesitatingly before arching upwards and then falling away, demonstrates in miniature the musical tension and resolution of the whole piece. The scherzo comes second and contrasts swirling, implacable music with rest and tranquility. The vast slow movement seems to float timelessly, alternately searching and contemplative, one of Bruckner's very greatest pieces of writing. And the finale eventually brings it all together with complete inevitability in a moment of pure musical splendour. When I talked to Donald Ranicles after this morning's rehearsal, I asked him whether he agreed that in Bruckner's great symphonies, you cover centuries of music in one go.
When I'm working with the orchestra, I do evoke Monteverdi, Bach, even further. I mean, the music that was so seminal to Anton Bruckner, the religious music, we're talking about Vittoria, we're talking about Lassus, Palestrina. The spectres of these composers are still very much within this work, and for me it's extremely rewarding, even when it comes to phrasing or the actual orchestral sonority, just by mentioning sometimes these composers, because this was very much where Anton Bruckner came. I mean, his supreme command of counterpoint was through weeks, months of studying all, whether it was Bach, whether it was etc. So, yes, I do think in this vast and epic journey, he invokes and evokes many other composers of a bygone era. And I think that's what for me is so rewarding and what is so fulfilling about performing this music. And this is music that is very much not of our time, in the sense that everybody's in a hurry. It's hustle bustle. And for me, this music is like some luxurious massage, and that sounds terribly glib, but somehow it brings your pulse down, everything slows down, you have fun in reflecting, and one talks about needing patience to listen to Anton Bruckner, but in a way I think people back then listened to music in a very different way than we do today. With this symphony, he perfected the finale. I feel he has absolutely got this right. And it's a phenomenal journey, but I do think that just the dimensions of those movements are perfect.
Donald Ranicles, who was also talking to me about Bruckner the organist and how the orchestra is like having a fabulous 8-manual organ with a 64-foot pedal. Ranicles himself is an organist. He often used to deputise for his father in an Edinburgh church. He does say that Bruckner's life in the organ loft certainly infuses this piece. And he thinks of the pacing, letting the sound in the cathedral, the ideal Royal Albert Hall, have time to clear between each section. And, of course, Bruckner gave one of the opening recitals on the organ towering above us here in the hall back in 1871. So, in a way, his spirit resides in this hall. Ahead of us, hearing his 8th symphony, here comes Donald Ranicles onto the platform, joining the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to perform Bruckner's 8th symphony. think I can say that Donald Runicles liked the way his orchestra played that. You just look at them in admiration at the end of that performance of Bruckner's Symphony No. 8 in C minor here in the Royal Albert Hall. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, guest led by David Adams, conducted by Donald Runicles. The symphony was dedicated to the Austro-Hungarian Emperor, Franz Josef, who paid for its publication. And after the triumphant first performance in Vienna in 1892, when the conductor Hans Richter left the hall by the stage door, there was Bruckner waiting for him with a tray of 48 hot donuts. Practical. Well, the Scottish Symphony Orchestra aren't going far away. They'll be back here on Sunday with the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland and Donald Runicles, Nicola Benedetti, the soloist in Brooks, Scottish Fantasy, premieres by James McMillan and Theo Musgrave, as well as pieces by Wagner again, Richard Strauss, ending with Respighi's Hymns of Rome. All the wind principals being brought to their feet by Donald Runicles. David Flack, principal horn, you... Sterling job. If we'd been elsewhere in Europe, it would have been a complete change of horn section, you suspect, but here for the Scottish Symphony Orchestra, they all play everything. That's the Wagner tubas. They'll all be going up to Edinburgh, Donald Runicle's hometown, of course, for the festival. He's got a very busy August going off to his festival in Wyoming, and then back to the Deutsche Oper in Berlin, where he's music director for Parsifal. The heavy brass being brought to their feet. Don't forget, if you've just come in, you've been watching the Olympics, you've missed some of tonight's performance, or you just want to hear it again, have that slow massage Donald Runicles was talking about, then of course you can always go on iPlayer for the next week and hear it again. Well, as Donald Runicles brings the entire BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to its feet, and with that glorious ending ringing in my ears, I'm off to make my way across Hyde Park to Broadcasting House to finish working on tomorrow morning's Radio 3 breakfast show. I hope very much you'll join me anytime from 7 to start your weekend with Radio 3. But for now, time for me to hand you on from an exhilarated Albert Hall to Jonathan Swain, who's waiting to host the rest of your evening. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you. Don't work too late tonight. Martin Handy there with tonight's live prom, and as well as the iPlayer he mentioned, just to add, there's another chance to hear that prom broadcast here on BBC Radio 3 on Monday week at 2 in the afternoon. As for proms as they happen, there's more Bruckner on Tuesday night.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Bruckner's Sixth Symphony. The BBC Philharmonic and its new principal conductor, Juanjo Mena, fresh from an acclaimed proms debut earlier in the season. And the world premiere of a new work by a composer closely associated with the orchestra, James McMillan. Tuesday night, BBC Radio 3 at 7:30.
Yes, it should be good. You may have caught Juanjo Mena's Bruckner Sixth Symphony with the BBC Philharmonic in a Radio 3 live in concert just a few weeks ago. As David Fanning wrote afterwards in the Telegraph, rarely have I heard a Bruckner Sixth that displayed such masterful long-term vision, and never, I think, one that made the work seem so important. Well, the BBC Phil's prom opens with Wagner's Tristan Prelude, followed by James McMillan's Credo with the Bruckner Sixth Symphony in the second half. That's next Tuesday night, live from the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, starting at 7:30. As for tomorrow, we've two visits to the Albert Hall. The first prom in the afternoon, the Ulster Orchestra and the Ulster Youth Orchestra, conducted by Joanne Folletta, in music by Chabrier, Stravinsky's The Firebird, and one of the Mozart flute concertos with flautist James Galway, no less. 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon for that. Well, back to tonight, and in 5 minutes' time, Out in the World, A Global Gay History. Richard Coles continues his study of same-sex desire across the centuries. For the moment, Bach via Villa-Lobos, his arrangement for eight cellos, of one of the preludes from the Well-Tempered Clavier. The players are the Pleath Cello Octet. prelude in D minor, Villa-Lobos's arrangement for cello octet of the prelude number 8 in E-flat minor from book 1 of Bach's 48 Preludes and Fugues, and it was played there by the Pleath cello octet. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 minute past 10, and now the last in our series, first broadcast last year, Out in the World, A Global Gay History. In this, the fourth programme, presenter Richard Coles looks at the extraordinary shifts and changes in attitude to same-sex relationships in the recent past and how those changes are playing out across the world. But he begins very much at home.
The parish church of St Mary the Virgin, Findon, a very beautiful building, built from about 1300 to 1350, and it's where I'm parish priest, the 59th person to have the honour. Two of my ancestors were vicars here also in the early 17th century, so you might think I'm to the manor born, but I'm not. It may surprise you that an Anglican country parson should be one of the children of the revolution, but I am.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know.
It looked like the crowd had the upper hand because there weren't enough police. It was maybe 6, 10 police. It was the most I could see around once the cars pulled away. So they were cornered, the police, up against the doorway.
Well, that's when all hell broke loose at that point. And then we had to get back into the Stonewall.
The family does need protection in Britain today. And as far as I'm concerned, it's going to get it.
No one is going to tell me that male homosexuals who engage in the act of sodomy are doing what anyone can reasonably support or accept or condone.
In chronological order, you heard eyewitness accounts of the Stonewall riots in New York in June 1969, which heralded a new militancy among gay people, both in the States and across the Western world. The then British Conservative MP Jill, now Baroness Knight, speaking out against that movement during the Clause 28 debate of the mid-80s, which sought to limit the availability in schools of gay-friendly material. And from 1988, the thoughts of James Anderton during his time as Chief Constable of Greater Manchester. Well, since then, things have moved on and continue to move. From June this year, Republican State Senator Stephen Salland, after he voted in favour of gay marriage in the New York State Senate.
I can say that my intellectual and emotional journey has ended here today, and I have to define doing the right thing as treating all persons with equality, and that equality includes within the definition of marriage.
These are all mere episodes in a much bigger story, a story of fierce argument and debate, march and countermarch. And they say nothing either of the huge agony of HIV/AIDS, which must have seemed the answer to a prayer for the many who wanted gay rights to be rolled back, not only in the West, but all over the world. This series has concentrated, as far as evidence will allow, on same-sex relationships through history. In this final programme, I want to look at the recent past and try to understand the divide that's developed between Western reformers and those who oppose them, some fiercely and implacably, some uneasy at the speed of change in attitudes towards sexuality and human rights.
Searching their houses, calling them queer. I don't believe that sort of thing happens here.
A prominent figure in the gay rights movement since the early 1980s is Peter Tatchell. I've known him for much of that period, and I wanted to find out what he makes of the relationship between our contemporary debate about rights and sexuality and the longer story we've been exploring during this series.
I think it'd be very mistaken to try and reclaim homosexuality and gay identity back in history, because, of course, in other historical epochs and moments, the same-sex behaviour was very different. Homosexuality itself has gone through a process of evolution, and with that evolution has emerged gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender identities.
And yet I find from that historical record, you occasionally hear a voice or read a report of a voice which sounds
heartbreakingly modern. I'm thinking of court reports, which I've read of, in the 17th century in Italy, I think, in which someone talked about their desire as being normal. I'm just the same as you, he says, as the poor guy's carried off to a grisly fate. There is a sense in which same-sex relationships in history are not always simply about acts. They're sometimes reported as so, because often it's just forensic. But you do get a sense that these are people who have tenderness, feeling, love, commitment to each other.
That's undoubtedly true. And you can probably trace it back much earlier than the 18th century in Italy or other parts of Europe. But I think the notion, the modern notion, of someone identifying themselves as gay is a fairly recent phenomenon.
Why do you think it is such a key issue in our time? Or indeed, do you think it is a key issue in our time?
Gay people are the canaries in the mine. We can judge a society's commitment to equality, liberty and human rights by the way it treats its gay people. Societies that persecute lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people tend to be very authoritarian ones who also persecute other citizens. The fact that LGBT people are organising, not just in Western countries but all over the world today, is proof of a parallel rise of human rights culture, the idea that equality is a universal, and our struggle is symptomatic of that very broad struggle which is taking place in all different countries and cultures right across the world.
How do you think we're doing?
Who's the we?
I mean the we, I mean you and me, people of a certain age, half a century through our lives, who've grown up in metropolitan areas in the sort of places where gay rights was a live and current issue and continues to be.
Our lives have been utterly transformed in a mere four decades. When I was growing up, homosexuality was totally illegal, punishable by life imprisonment. The courts could sentence you to forcible psychiatric treatment, including electric shock aversion therapy, supposedly to cure your homosexuality. I personally was attacked and beaten up. I was refused jobs, I was refused accommodation, simply because I was gay. And that's the experience of many other lesbian, gay and bisexual people of our generation. So this last four decades has been an absolutely momentous period of social history.
Peter Tatchell. So how is that canary in the mine sounding in the internet age? Given that we started this series among the tombs of the ancient Egyptians and found even there strong indications of same-sex relations 5,000 years ago, it seemed right to ask that question in Egypt, now, at the beginning of the Arab Spring. I'm in a car driving through Cairo, incredibly impressive city, very vivid, very dynamic, huge, 20 million people. And there's this sense now, as well, on this side of the Egyptian revolution, of a new atmosphere that people are breathing, a new hope for a more settled democracy and greater freedoms. To say against that, not so long ago, about 10 years ago, there was a notorious trial here in Egypt when the police raided a gay club, rounded up the people there, about 50 of them, and tried them for an offence which translates to something like public debauchery. Half of them were convicted and some sentenced to 5 years with hard labour. A lot of people saw that as a hardening of attitudes towards homosexuality. I wonder if that's going to change in the new dispensation as it emerges. Some think it will. Others have expressed concern that there are conservative forces to the revolution too. Well, to test that, I'm going off to see a young writer who, not long after that trial, made a big splash in Egypt by publishing what's been described as the first Egyptian gay novel. Mustafa Fati invited me to meet him at his central Cairo office. Just going into a building now, just down a side street. An old building, 19th century, cool inside. Pillars, steps, and there's two guys just came running out, one carrying a camera and a tripod, and another one carrying a flight case. So I guess we're approaching a centre of media operations. Mustafa's main job is running his internet radio station, Radio Horietna. The large poster of Martin Luther King in the office tells you something about its values. But it was for his novel, In the Country of Boys, that he ran into serious trouble, even before its publication.
What I want to say from my book is anyone in the Egyptian society have the right to live. And there is no gods in the land. You are just human. When you tell someone you are a homo in the Egyptian society, the first step, he will refuse you. The next step, he will say a lot of bad words about you. You are not a man. He is a bad guy. I have an example. A friend of mine, he is a gay from Upper Egypt. Now he lives in Cairo. He told his mother that he is a gay. She told him, go to Cairo, don't live in Upper Egypt. Your father will kill you. Please go now.
And that was that?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think the Egyptian revolution, in contrast, might be good, change the situation favorably for gay people in Egypt?
Actually, I hope so.
What happened in Egypt in the last 9 months, starting from the 25th of January, till the moment, LGBTIQ individuals were everywhere.
Egyptian activist Khulod Bidak insists debate about sexuality should not be seen as a mere side issue in the Egyptian uprising. She and her colleagues were, she says, in the thick of it.
And the front lines and the Bloody Wednesday and the day of the Israeli embassy. I mean, you just name it. We were everywhere, and not only in the street, online and maybe sometimes on the TV to talk about rights in general or to discuss something political. I just wanted to let others know that we are everywhere and we will be everywhere. Now, the street is accepting more people. Now it's easy for us to be in the street. A year ago, even if we were visible, we're still for the street invisible. They would never notice us. But I think now people could a little bit recognize us. I feel all right. I usually get attacked in the street as a gay guy, not as a lesbian, which didn't happen for a while now, but I'm grateful.
The society that Khulod inhabits and Mustafa describes reminds us perhaps of post-war Britain. Homosexuality manifestly existed, but it was the report of the Wolfenden Committee in 1957 and the legislation that followed 10 years later, decriminalising homosexual behaviour between consenting adults, that was the game changer. Dr. Matt Holbrook, however, cautions against using Wolfenden as a blueprint for international reform. It was, he says, a very British sort of affair.
The whole rhetoric of the respectable homosexual that drives the deliberations of Wolfenden is a homosexual. It's a model of sexual behaviour or a kind of a sexual identity that is shaped in the image of elite men. That's done, I suppose, at the level of assumption and rhetoric. It's also done in practical terms because the homosexual men who have the opportunity to testify to Wolfenden are all from very, very specific elite social worlds. And the arguments that they make to Wolfenden and the identity that they demand decriminalisation or demand rights for is very much shaped in their own image. It's sort of private, it's discreet, in a way a kind of an invisible sexual identity. It reflects the sort of the privacy and the discretion that are then being invested in middle-class marriage.
Even if the Wolfenden Report and the subsequent Sexual Offences Act of 1967 are particular to One Nation story, we weren't the only countries to change the law. Our tour brings us next to India, where, as we heard last week, Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code criminalising homosexual activity as against the order of nature was overturned by the High Court in Delhi as recently as 2009.
The law criminalising homosexuality dates back to the 1860s and British rule. That's why for gay rights campaigners here, it's a colonial relic. Getting rid of it is a sign that India is a modern, dynamic nation where all are included.
I mean, it's not a marriage law. It's just about whether sodomy is a crime or not. So it's high time now, you know, that we overturn this law once and for all.
Nitin Karani, who's been involved in the Indian gay rights movement for the last 15 years. As in Egypt, Nitin is concerned with the local perspective here, and for the moment, the High Court verdict is the focus.
There is a general sense of confidence. People are much more willing to come out at a gay event, at least, without fear of that party being raided or that get-together being raided or maybe even attacked by hoodlums. I think that confidence is there. To an extent, people are also coming out that to their friends at the workplace maybe. Beyond that, I'm not saying that the verdict has changed attitudes of society itself. What I'm saying is that there has been a debate around it at least. It's there on the front page, it's there on television. If the moment you switch on television, there's no way you can avoid it. It's not just in some random talk show. There has been a little bit of more opening of minds, I think, to some extent. Not completely. We still have a health minister who goes around saying on a forum saying that this is a Western disease. This is abnormal. This is denigration of Indian culture. What is so-called Indian culture? I mean, how much do we even know about our own culture, about our own religious textbooks? They're not quoting anything to say that this is against it.
Anger at the appropriation of a national history and culture, and the assumption that attitudes to sexuality, and indeed the discussion of sexuality, is a Western phenomenon, are issues we've touched on before. But the prevalence of television debate about homosexual identity, you might call it the Oprah effect, is certainly marked. And with it comes a Western tendency, perhaps, to take a lead not from politicians, but celebrities, which in India means someone from the worlds of either Bollywood or cricket.
The sooner someone comes out, the better it is for us. But whether it'll happen, I'm very skeptical. At least I wish a cricketer would come out, because I think maybe that would be seen in a more positive light, because there might still be people who will criticize somebody from Bollywood coming out. People in cricket might still be seen as real achievers.
It's a nice distinction. Who are the real achievers in any society? In Western Europe in the 80s, Nitin Kalani's hopes were anticipated by the list of high-profile celebrities coming out, or indeed being forced out. This has always been a contentious area in which the greater good argument clashes with the right to privacy.
The problem is that we don't have anybody who's actually out in Greece. There are no celebrities, no artists. I can only name one, really, the choreographer who was behind the opening closing ceremonies of the Olympic Games, the Athens Olympic Games.
I spoke to Leo Kalavirnas at a cafe in the Gazia district of Athens, on the edge of a smarter bohemian quarter, now taken over by fashionable bars and restaurants. You can sense the difference between what's happening here and in India or Egypt from Leo's frustration. Feisty, impatient rather than resigned, but still looking for high-profile support.
Even though we have lesbian and gay MPs, they're not out. We had mayors who were gay, they were not out. We have tons of artists, singers, actors and actresses that are gay, but they're not out. They actually go out of the way to prove that they're straight, which is a bit ridiculous because everybody knows they're gay. And there's a kind of silence conspiracy by media that do not ask questions.
In that sense, it seems like life in Athens, life in Greece is 10, 15 years behind the rest of Europe.
It is indeed, right. There's a lot of homophobia. Still, even in this area, there have been attacks, there's been gay bashing, which are not reported, really.
The Gazia district of Athens seems very similar to other boho enclaves in European cities. It's the domestic scene in modern Greece that Leo finds most frustrating.
My parents know I'm gay since I was 17. They've embraced all my boyfriends. We've gone on holiday together. They ring him up and ask about me and buy him underwear for his birthday. But they will not allow me to actually use the words and talk about it. This is the overall rule in Greece. We can do practically whatever we want as long as we don't rock the boat, as long as the neighbours think we're a decent, self-respecting family. The biggest problem, the biggest enemy for gays in Greece is us, our own selves. As long as we don't accept ourselves, I don't want to paint a bleak picture about gay rights in Greece, because things are getting better. It's just that it's a slow process, and we tend to compare ourselves with other Western societies, and the comparison is always to our detriment. But that doesn't mean we should lose heart. And, on the contrary, we should see where we started and how bad things were back then, and how far we've already come.
The language I hear talking to people during the making of these programmes is that of journey. It's full of the idea of purpose, forward movement, the attainment of goals, and assumes perhaps the desirability of both itinerary and outcome. Worth taking a look at that. But before we do, let's take one more step along the road.
If you had told me in my lifetime that I would be able to register as a domestic partner with Stephen in the state of California, that would happen, I would be absolutely stunned.
Craig Davidson is a New Yorker who lives with his British partner Stephen Bottrell in San Francisco. But their civil partnership, not marriage, was formed in Britain.
I was in New York when the Stonewall happened. I was in Manhattan. So I've seen these changes happening, and I know they're happening rapidly. And I know the next generation of voters that are coming out, to them, this is a question of, I don't get it. You know, why aren't gay marriages allowed? So I do think that in my lifetime now, I am going to see gay marriage as nationally accepted in the United States. You know, we have, for all intent and purposes, a marriage through domestic partnership, and yet we don't. We don't have anything near a marriage.
As far as the federal government is concerned, of course, Craig and I have been roommates and strangers for the last almost 20 years, because at the federal level, the thing is not recognized at all. In a way, we're more married in Britain than we are in California. We're more married in California than we are in Wyoming. And it's an odd feeling going from place to place and feeling your relationship or the change, as it were, or at least the externals of it can, in certain circumstances, change.
I get off the plane in London and immediately I feel married in every sense of the word married.
Part of the difference... Sorry, we interrupt each other as... Well, you know, long-time couples do. Part of the difference is that in Britain, we were married in a registry office with a crowd of people and friends and family and flowers, and it was exactly the same as if we'd been a heterosexual couple. In California, we filled out a form and sent it into the Secretary of State's office. And there's something to do with the ritual and the public celebration of it that surrounds it. And although the legal distinctions may be what they are, and they may be rather fine distinctions, I mean, there is a sense in which having got married in Britain, formed a civil union, as it were, as the legal term, I think, in Britain, it does make you feel somehow more married than we do back home.
But campaigners like Peter Tatchell are quick to point out that those legal distinctions are very much in place in Britain. Stephen and Craig are not officially married, even if they look and feel like they are. And Stephen has a sense that debates about civil partnerships or gay marriage can sound very esoteric in the global context.
The early stage of the history of gay and lesbian people as a self-conscious minority may be coming to an end, and it may be moving towards a different and no doubt equally interesting stage in future years. I think one thing that will be very obvious is that gay and lesbian people, having achieved, when they have, which they haven't yet, but when they do, fairly soon, I think, finally achieve full equality of civil rights in the Western world, are going to become more and more concerned about the situation of gay and lesbian people in other parts of the world for whom that journey has not yet even begun. And that's probably where the political energy of the movement, I should think, will be directed after the gay marriage fight is won. It's going to be a matter of, okay, now what can we do to help people in places like, for example, Uganda, where the concept of gay and lesbian rights probably still seems as distant, if not more so, as it did to me 40 years ago in England.
Stephen Bottrell.
Should we be telling other countries how to treat gay people? Homosexuality is illegal in 76 countries around the world, including 38 Commonwealth countries. A new organisation launches today here in the UK aimed at putting a stop to people around the world...
National Radio in Britain reporting the launch of Kaleidoscope, a charitable trust set up with the express intention of harnessing that political energy to support lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgendered individuals around the world. And all based, as the charity's director, Lance Price, acknowledges, on an assumption that the moral high ground is theirs.
It is an assumption, and it's an assumption that we make and that we have to make with enormous care and enormous caution. But if you believe, as I do, that human rights are indivisible and therefore they apply to all of us, then LGBT rights, to use the jargon, the rights of gay and lesbian people, are central to that. They can't be separated out from it. And a lot of people have expressed that view. President Obama's done it with great eloquence. He simply said LGBT rights are not individual rights, they are human rights. And it's as simple as that. It's not separate, it's about the same issue.
Indeed, President Obama has led from the front, taking on even the highly conservative US military to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which gay servicemen and women were obliged to sign up to. And on the 17th of June this year at the United Nations in Geneva, a resolution was adopted expressing grave concern at acts of violence and discrimination in all regions of the world committed against individuals because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. Proposed by South Africa and adopted by the narrow margin of 23 to 19, it charged the United Nations High Commissioner to produce a global report on discrimination by the end of the year. The UK ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Peter Goodrum, witnessed the controversial vote.
Well, the atmosphere in the council on the day in question when the resolution came to for adoption was extremely charged. The decision by the South African government to take the lead in negotiating this resolution was an extremely courageous act in the context of the United Nations and the difficulty that the UN has had in the past in getting these issues onto the agenda, in getting these issues discussed, and in getting resolutions adopted. It would be fair to say that those who voted against the resolution, the 19 countries who voted against the resolution, were overwhelmingly either from African countries or from members of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC. And South Africa itself, the South African government, obviously came in for a lot of criticism from those constituencies because it not only supported this resolution, but actually took the lead in negotiating it and in seeing through its adoption. If it had been a country like the United States or the United Kingdom, we would have come in for criticism that this was some attempt by the West or by the ex-colonial powers or whatever to impose a particular set of values on other parts of the world. And of course, that is not our view at all. These are universal human rights.
The UK's ambassador to the United Nations, Peter Goodrum. So if the United Nations is seeking to promote a universal standard of gay rights, what will that mean for the nations most resistant to that idea?
From a plain reading of Scripture, from a careful reading of Scripture, and from a critical reading of Scripture, homosexual practice has no place in God's design of creation, the continuation of the human race through procreation, or its plan of redemption,
wrote the Archbishop of Uganda, the Most Reverend Henry Luke Irombe, in 2009, when that country was debating anti-homosexuality legislation, which proposed reintroducing the death penalty for sex between men. Archbishop Irombe, and indeed our own Archbishop of Canterbury, declined our invitation to be interviewed for this programme. Hardly surprising, given the depth and intensity of feeling in the Anglican Communion on this issue. However, Archbishop Irombe did send a letter setting out the Church of Uganda's position.
Even natural law reveals that the very act of sexual intercourse is an experience of embracing the sexual other. The Church of Uganda therefore believes that homosexual practice is incompatible with Scripture.
There was also a list of recommendations in which he suggested that any change to legislation should
ensure that homosexual practice or the promotion of homosexual relations is not adopted as a human right.
Well, whatever you make of that, it does reveal how far apart people are on this issue. All occupying positions of integrity, all thinking themselves not only right, but unarguably right. I did a summer as a chaplain in a university in Uganda. I can tell you how awkward it is to try to make headway with that. And it's certainly a mistake to assume that the Conservatives are a minority in decline. Dr. Shane Gannon of Mount Royal University, Calgary, believes there are real reasons for this.
It's within the rights discourse that we think everyone should be particularly like the West. But the rights discourse is itself very much Western. The notion of rights, in some ways, this is an arguable point, but emerged in 1789 with the declarations of the, I think it's the Rights and Citizen. So this is a very Western notion. So it's not a surprise that it has to be imposed on to formerly colonial nations. The challenge becomes, how can we argue for the point of rights within an indigenous framework? How do we find what we want to do in terms of rights, but instead of using rights, which is a Western discourse, how do we do it within indigenous terms? For example, South Asia, which is my area of knowledge, instead of the notion of rights, it's far more important to use notions such as dharma. Dharma is an indigenous understanding of responsibility. Rights has within it particular assumptions which are quite compatible with the bourgeois revolution, i.e. capitalism, which is emerging out of the West. Dharma has a very different set of assumptions and speaks to the indigenous context in a very different way. I actually have a lot of worries about the rights discourse. Not that rights aren't important, don't get me wrong, but what we see instead is that these notions that lie behind rights are masked through its Western focus.
At the launch of the gay rights charity Kaleidoscope in the shadow of the Palace of Westminster in central London, I had the chance to talk to someone with knowledge of the tension between the rights culture of the West and the indigenous cultures of sub-Saharan Africa. From a conservative background, the Reverend Ejoma Ajibade now campaigns for the other side.
I think there are cultural questions. I wouldn't say it's not part of our culture, because there are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people in Africa. But I don't think our culture has allowed us to speak about it. And I think we have been caught up in Africa in some of the global debates. And so we are, in a way, we're responding to maybe Western gay rights campaigning, whereas I think if we had the opportunity to discuss these issues within our own cultural context, there wouldn't be so much alarm. I think that's the issue. The recent World Bank report on HIV prevention showed that criminalization of homosexuality is undermining HIV prevention. Because we are not talking about homosexuality, we are failing our people. Our people are dying. I'm an African woman, I'm a mother. It affects me, it affects my community. My cousin died of AIDS because we don't talk. For me, there's also the added complication that is it the legislation or is it the culture? Because in South Africa, where you do have gay marriage and gay partnerships, yet you have gay activists who are being killed. Young women who have come out openly as lesbian being stabbed and thrown in a ditch. And that in itself is very difficult to change, but not impossible.
What changed you? Why did you change your thinking about this issue?
I think what really changed it for me was recognizing that it's not a choice. You have your sexuality. I think that was the key moment, the recognizing sexual orientation and then recognizing that there is then sexual activity. And I think that was a key moment for me. And realizing that sexuality is no bar to the power of God in a person's life. As Jesus said, he came that they might have life and have it more abundantly. That should guide any discussions around legislation. To kill people is not God's work. We have to find a different way, I think.
Interesting to hear Ejoma talk about sexuality as something which defines rather than as something which is chosen. As we've discussed before, that follows the debate from the sexologists of the 19th century through to the human rights advocates of today. It means, of course, that the resulting story has been dominated by the West. And for Khulod Bidak in Egypt, the Western pattern, with its drive towards civil partnerships and gay marriage, isn't entirely persuasive.
Honestly, I don't think that, with all my respect, of course, I don't think that the West is the example. I mean, when it comes to some of the personal rights, yes, of course, yeah, we would like to do this, or maybe a little bit different. But for me, and for lots of others I know, I don't think we want that civil marriage thing. I don't think we are looking for having a pride in Cairo streets, for example. I don't think we have those dreams. I guess basically what we're looking for is just to be acceptable. I know there are much better things than those we have in here in Egypt. That's I am aware of. But not like, it's not like the utopia. It's not like, oh, I'm going to get there because everything would be fine.
So if we're looking for a way through this deadlocked argument, how might we proceed? If not westward, then perhaps to the east.
People in China, they are actually quite tolerant of homosexuality.
Travis Kong teaches at the Department of Sociology in the University of Hong Kong, and his research into Chinese sexuality has revealed an ambivalent attitude towards same-sex relations on the part of the communist government. Once viewed as a mental illness or a sign of sociological deviancy, it's now neither. However, introduce the idea of human rights, and it becomes once again controversial.
If you travel in China, in Beijing, Shanghai, all those kind of like big cities, apparently you can find some gay bars and gay clubs which have no difference from all the other bars and clubs in the world, like in London, for example. And also from so-called like ordinary people, if you talk to them, then they say, oh, well, you know, it's okay. Like, you know, they're gay and then they just do whatever they want. And in this sense, like, it seems to be quite okay and fine to be gay. But I think it's really up to the point where, like, you do something that might stir up the nerve of the government in terms of whether you're doing something that is political or not. But what is political and what is not, sometimes it's very arbitrary.
But there's another factor in China which has proved quite as powerful down the years as any law or doctrine.
A lot of gay men, they can actually not able to come out as who they are. And it's mainly because of the family. The obligation of getting married and having children is very strong and very important for most of the gay men's and also lesbians' lives. So the question is actually not so much about whether you're gay or not, because you can tell your parents, oh, well, I'm gay. But then your parents will still ask you, okay, so when are you going to get married? You have to do it. You have to fulfill that duty of getting married and having children. This is something that is almost like an iron law for most gay men and lesbian. So if you come to mainland China, if you talk to most of the gay men and lesbian, what you find the most difficult thing to handle is actually not the government, it's actually not the media, but the family members. And most of the gay men I talk to always express that kind of fear of getting married. But what is not really the options is the Western model of partnership. You organize your life in terms of your sexuality. So you find a man or a woman of the same sex and then you live together and your life is actually revolved around it.
The family factor and the expectation of carrying on the family name is an issue the world over, no less for gay men and women than for straight. But in India, according to Nitin Karani, it goes well beyond that, particularly for women.
I know of families who have gone after their own daughters. They're willing to kill their own daughters for the sake of family honor. These are families who grow up out on the outskirts of a place like Delhi. It's not even some remote village somewhere. These are semi-urban centers. So it can still be very dangerous for women. And they have to, if they decide to be lesbian, so to speak, then they have to run away from home. They have to take shelter with other women somewhere else. They have to take the protection of the court, which they're doing there. I mean, every few months you do hear those cases.
As lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people come out and make a claim for equality, you know, assert the right to protection against discrimination and for the repeal of anti-gay laws, this does inevitably provoke a backlash.
Peter Tatchell.
And that's what we're seeing in many parts of the world. But, you know, as Martin Luther King said, backlash is part of the process of winning freedom and equality. You have to go through that trauma in order to emerge on the other side with a state of freedom. That's tragic, it's sad, it's regrettable, but that is a fact of life. And we have to be ready to make those sacrifices, to make those challenges, in order to ultimately vanquish homophobia and transphobia.
I think it is very, very important to be culturally contextual.
Rabbi Dr. Rebecca Alpert believes the choice is less absolute.
I think when we look at other cultures like Muslim cultures or African cultures, they have their ways of accepting people as long as they don't come out, as long as they keep their behaviors closeted. And I think that's probably true with certain communities in the United States as well, particularly, as I know, the African American church community, extremely tolerant of people's behaviors, but they don't want them to talk about it. It's become clear to me that religious identity for many people is just as important as sexual identity. And they have a very difficult choice to make, a very painful choice to make. If someone is an Orthodox Jew or a believing Muslim or a conservative Christian, they're caught in a terrible, terrible dilemma. And I don't always want to say that the right choice is for them to go for their sexual identity, because maybe sometimes their religious identity is going to offer more to them.
Professor Laura Doan, an academic commentator, welcomes a broad and historical approach to understanding same-sex relations, if only to save it from narrow parochialism.
What's interesting about the possibility of a global history of homosexuality is that it creates a possibility for community beyond nation. The history of sexuality as a kind of progress narrative, oh, look where we got by the late 20th century, we can use terms like lesbian or bisexual. Everybody knows what those mean. But those terms that we think are so great and really nail down what that person is, those are always terms that close down meanings. They don't open up meanings, they close them down. And I envy people in 1931 who said something like gross immorality between women. What did that mean? Anybody's guess?
It's been massive change in both Britain and the US, and in other countries too, of a kind and on a scale that one couldn't have anticipated 3 or 4 decades ago. And one should be happy about that, but I think we're still entitled to say, well, the job is not done, and there needs to be progress towards the full equality that people deserve by virtue of being people.
I think we are still at the beginning of a long struggle. We haven't made much progress there. Isn't much to be proud of, except the Delhi High Court judgment, which has come after a long struggle. I think this is the only one milestone we have so far, the Delhi High Court judgment, and we have many more to cross. And I don't know how many we will cross in my lifetime, but I'm hoping at least a couple of more will happen soon.
I think there is no rainbow flag in Egypt, but the homosexuality is the same like any country.
So do you think that if you're gay in Egypt, in a way, you've got more in common with someone who's gay in Berlin, someone who's gay in London, someone who's gay in Mumbai,
yeah,
than your neighbour?
Yes. But let me explain something. I just want my society to be the same like any society in the world. There is homosexuals and straight and Muslims brotherhood and liberal people. I want to see, the cocktail.
A plural society.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think this is the right society.
It was very encouraging to hear Mustafa talk about his vision of a new Egypt. But there's an enormous distance between Egypt, its traditions, its history, rooted in Islam, and what came before, and the modern plural Egypt that's kind of in the air at the moment, particularly with the fall of Mubarak and the possibilities, the imaginative possibilities that opens up for a vision of a new society. It's there on the imaginative horizon, but how do you turn that into something politically and socially achievable?
It is the time to just take the conversation to the light and start to talk about it and put it everywhere. Because, I got really bored of this sentence of, it's not the time for it now. And it feels like, when? When shall we start to talk about it then? When shall we start to work? When?
An impatient Khaloud Bidak with Mustafa Fati, Nitin Karani and Stephen Bottrell. It's never the wrong time to pursue what's true and what's just. But what's the more profitable approach? To focus our energies and concerns within a push towards universal equal rights, or to take a step back from that to explore how sexuality, gender and identity get configured among the competing claims for our interest and loyalty and attention? Well, I'd quite like both, but I'm not sure if that's because of or in spite of having been part of the unfolding story myself as a representative of that admittedly small demographic, 80s gay pop star turned Anglican parish priest. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but now, later in the day, the view is less clear, and making this series has, if anything, made me more aware of the story's complexity, the twists in the path, the shifts in the scenery, the elusive evidence of the past. A journey worth taking? Khaloud Bidak.
Of course it's very important. It wasn't only in Egypt. I think it was all over the globe, ages ago, thousands of years ago. It is something quite normal, if I would use the term normal to describe it. It was everywhere. And having this evidence on one of the tombs, I mean, it's something good for us to prove that same-sex relationships were around everywhere all the time. They're not forbidden and they're not a curse or any of these negative things they've been telling us and convincing us and getting, hospitals to treat us from. I mean,